We're going inside the world of show skiing, a type of water skiing, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dozens of skiers competed recently in the Wisconsin State Water Ski Tournament held in Wisconsin Rapids. It was the Aquanuts, the Twin Lakes water ski team, that came out on top, reclaiming a championship title they last held in 1986. Are you a fan of competitive water skiing? What do you want to know about the history of the sport in Wisconsin? Should it be an Olympic sport? It's 800-642-1234. Dan Borman is co-show director of the Twin Lakes Aquanuts. Dan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Great. Thank you for having me this morning.
Good morning. We also have Kaylee Kohler here, co-show director of the organization. She was named best female skier in the state tournament. Kaylee, congratulations and welcome.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having us.
Well, Kaylee, let's start with you. This is your team's first win since 86. How does it feel to be state champions again?
Quite honestly, it feels surreal. You know, it's been a long time since the Aquanuts have won. You know, everyone on our team has put in so much work this season, from the boat drivers to the skiers to the announcers to, you know, our friends who are selling in the concession stand. It's really a team effort, and it's really exciting to see all of our hard work pay off and to see us get the victory.
Wow. Dan, how does it feel for you?
Yeah, quite the same that Kaylee mentioned. I have not been involved in show skiing that terribly long, but as Kaylee mentioned, it's been a lot of work. And we were show directors last year as well, but obviously the season never happened with COVID. And so we've been really had, you know, almost a year and a half to put this all together. And it's been a lot of effort, but, you know, exactly as Kaylee mentioned, it really feels cool to take that victory home after after all that effort.
Yeah, you know, I hear you saying this is a lot of time and effort. Can you translate that? Like, how much time are you putting into this, Kaylee?
Well, specifically in the summer, our teams have practices on Tuesday and Thursday, and then we have ski shows twice a week on Wednesday and Saturday. Now, that doesn't really do it justice to how much work we put in the off season, and then also just during the week practicing for our team. A lot of people will practice skiing at their own house so that they're ready to go when they come down to the ski site and practice as a team. In the off season, we do all sorts of things, from sewing costumes to picking out music and writing a script. So really, it's an all-year-round adventure for us.
Yeah, and certainly I would imagine you just have to also stay in shape and the workouts, too.
Yep, definitely.
So explain, if you could, Dan, walk us through how a water skiing competition works.
Sure. So this particular type of water skiing, show skiing, each team is allotted a 60-minute slot to set up and prepare a ski show and ski all of its acts. It's limited to a certain number of skiing acts at 13. So each team gets a 20-minute setup time, a 60-minute ski show, and a 10-minute teardown so that you're ready for the next team. And it flows pretty – it's a very busy day. There's lots of teams that perform, and they keep the timeline very tight. So you really try and pack as much as you can into that 60-minute window. It is, it's very regulated. So if you go over on time, you're deducted points. There's a lot of other rules too, but that gets the gist of how it works out.
Yeah. You know, when I watch a ski show, I kind of think of it as like organized chaos because there are skis flying everywhere. I mean, you can feel the energy as people are just moving boats into place. I feel like there's major logistics going on as a spectator.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of what we talk about with all the effort that we put in, because part of the scoring and judging is how well those acts flow together. You know, they're looking to see if we get any knots in our ropes or if we have boats in the wrong place. They don't want to see boats just driving through the show course to get to the other side. So we really try and plan out where the boat and people have to be to make sure all those acts can flow very nicely.
As a skier, Kaylee, what is going through your mind as you put on a performance? How do you stay in your zone?
Yeah, I mean, quite honestly, it's very much an adrenaline rush. You know, we do gather some pretty big crowds. So, you know, just performing in front of people is quite the rush. And honestly, it's so fun just to compete with our friends and family. So, you know, through that hour, it's quite busy between skiing and changing costumes and doing our end intros and dancing on the stage. It pretty much is nonstop for that hour. You know, there's no teammates who are sitting on the sidelines or, you know, not doing anything. We're always busy between winding ropes and getting ready for our next act. And then there's those who just, you know, are able to cheer on our teammates. So it's a very busy hour.
We're talking with Kaylee Kohler and Dan Borman. They're co-show directors of the Twin Lakes Aquanuts, the 2021 State Water Ski Champions. You can join in. Are you a fan of competitive water skiing? Have you seen these shows and wondered how they do it? What do you want to know about the history of water skiing in Wisconsin? 800-642-1234. Let's go to, Taryn in Toma. Hi, Taryn.
Hi there. So a friend and I were watching like a documentary about the gymnastics in the Olympics, and we noticed that standards really raised through the decades. Like back in the 20s, you know, they could just walk along the stands, do a front flip off, and they'd get a perfect score. But now there's like so many other expectations from it. They really raised their standards. I'm wondering if there's a similar correlation to water skiing, how you got to do so much more than back then.
The bar keeps going higher and higher. Dan, you first.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, certainly in most competitive sports, people are always trying to push the limit as to what we can do. As the sport has evolved with equipment and boats and all those types of things, certainly the degree of difficulty has also raised very quickly as well. You know, there's a lot of things that, you know, are limited. Our pyramids, for example, you know, we now, not us yet this year, but pyramids can go five people high. So
wow.
If you think about five people stacked up, that's very high, very dangerous. But whereas several years ago, you know, three people high was probably the standard. So if you look at any of the wakeboarding tricks or ski jumping and all that type of stuff, all of those have just gotten very difficult.
Kaylee, do you feel that pressure to push the technical end of things and try these new stunts?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of us are, you know, always doing what we can to get better and better as the sport evolves. We're definitely pushing the envelope and we're trying new things, of course, while also being safe. But just as Dan said, really the technology of the sport has evolved so much. I mean, you go past a garage sale and you see all the old wood skis, and that's what people used to compete on. And now we're lucky enough where we have a lot of new equipment that can allow us to learn some of these new tricks. But yeah, we're always doing what we can just to get better. You know, we're preparing for our national tournament that's coming up. You know, we're looking to add some things into our show and see if we can improve ourselves even more.
Yeah, with nationals being held in Janesville, does that kind of feel like home field advantage of sorts, Kaylee?
Unfortunately, no. There is a team, you know, straight out of Janesville. that is their home site. They are used to skiing on the river. They're used to the narrow site and the depth of the water and the current and all of that. We are used to skiing on a public lake that's very wide, frequently rough. It's quite the opposite of a home field advantage.
Wow.
So, but we're looking forward to it. You know, we've got some practice scheduled there and, yeah, we're excited. You know, we have skied the national championship there a couple times. We also have, had, the Mercury Invite, which is a tournament at the beginning of the season that we did ski there. So we're not unfamiliar with the site, but it definitely is not our home turf.
Kaylee Kohler with us. Dan Borman here with the Twin Lakes Aquanuts. As we take a look at the competitive show skiing tradition in Wisconsin, you know, my family just loves to watch the Mad City Ski Team. Sunday evenings, Lake Monona, make a date, the cool summer breeze, the skiers buzzing around, dazzling stunts, glittery costumes, the whole bit. Do you love watching water skiing shows? Give a shout out to your favorite team, where they perform, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about Wisconsin's water ski show tradition on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Aquanuts, they got their start performing on Edgewater Beach in 1973, a Division I team based in Twin Lakes preparing for the Show Ski National Championship set for next month in Janesville. What do you want to know about show skiing? Are you part of a water ski team or just love to water ski? What drew you to it? Join in, 800-642-1234. Dan Borman is co-show director along with Kaylee Kohler, and they are with us for about 10 more minutes. Dan, you know, Kaylee talking there about water conditions, how do the wind and the water, how can that all affect how you execute these shows and these stunts?
Oh, there's a huge impact. As Kaylee mentioned, our home site is a public lake, Lake Mary there in Twin Lakes, and you know, there's been certain nights this week, or we've been there to practice, and we've had some very windy days that, you know, couldn't do some of the acts that we wanted to do. That's the advantage that that we do have when going to some of these tournaments, is that generally they're held on private areas or on waterways that don't have other traffic and less wind. So that does help us. But yeah, the weather can play a big impact on our sport, whether it's wind, whether it's waves. All of that, even the sunshine. There's certain times of practice when we're doing pyramids right into the setting sun and it's awfully bright. So it definitely has an impact on us.
Oh, but us spectators are just saying, gorgeous, gorgeous, go.
Yeah, absolutely. And we love that. The cheers and the applause of the audience really, you know, energizes us to put on a show, the best show that we can every night.
Okay, so these themes that you come up with, you know, acquaint us with the theme that you came up for this year, Dan, and what you're doing with it.
Yeah, so this year's theme is called Ski Jam, and it's kind of a spin on the Space Jam movie that came out in the 90s. Of course, that just re-released recently as well. So there's an alien invasion of a Looney Tune world, and they want to take back Bugs Bunny to their attraction on their alien planet. And they Looney Tunes call upon the Aquanuts to help them in this battle of the ages of water skiing. So it's been fun, you know, writing the script and writing the theme is, certainly took place a long time ago, but as it's evolved, we've really had a good time with it. It's been fun to get it executed and see the laughs from the fans and from the judges as the announcers. You know, it's kind of a show, it's kind of skiing, and it's all kind of mixed together.
So who, like, plays Michael Jordan or Bugs Bunny?
So we have a couple superstar skiers, Ethan Shulda, Cody Coffey. Those are both just announced to the USA Water Ski team, along with Kaylee and Kayla Coffey, another person. So we have some high power talent on our team that we've kind of earmarked those positions for them.
Kaylee, what's involved in trying to execute these shows and stay true to the creativity that you've put together with the costumes and the scripts and the music, but having to execute that on the water?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big team effort, that's for sure. You know, Dan and I are lucky enough that we have, you know, a really good core group of individuals who are able to help us oversee a lot of things, as he and I are both skiing. So, you know, we do have, you know, those who help us make sure that all of our headbands and armbands are, you know, on the right arm and where they're supposed to be for each certain act. We have a sound crew who is playing the music that we selected specifically for the act, and then also cueing sound effects with each skit. We have boat drivers and riders who are making sure that their patterns are driven in the way that we designed them to. And then we have pinners who are making sure that, you know, every skier is safe when they're out there on the water. So, you know, there really is a lot that goes on. However, Dan and I are lucky that we do have some experienced people, you know, who are working, especially with some of our newer skiers, to make sure that Everything keeps going round and round during that hour.
And the age range is really incredible. You have little ones out there as well as senior citizens.
That we do. You know, we have little ones that go all the way to the top of our 4 high and 5 high. You know, they're somewhere between 8 and 10 years old. We have a junior club of members who are 14 and younger, and then we have a senior club of those who are 14 and older. But yeah, we do have very much a range of people.
We're talking with Kaylee Kohler and Dan Borman. They are co-show directors of the Twin Lakes Aquanuts, the 2021 State Water Ski Champions, as they get ready for nationals in Janesville. You can join in. Have you seen water skiing shows or competitions around Wisconsin? What do you want to know about the history? And do you think water skiing should be an Olympic sport? 800-642-1234. Dan, take us a little bit through the history of competitive water skiing in our state and what's special about Wisconsin.
Well, Wisconsin, believe it or not, is the water ski capital, at least the show skiing capital of the world. We are the only state that has its own show ski championships. Everywhere else, they're all regionally based. But Wisconsin has so many teams that we have our own tournament that was held up in Wisconsin Rapids. So it's, you know, the sport has been around for many years and it continues to evolve, but the number of teams out there is just really high. You know, we're all fighting for some of the struggles from COVID. There's been some teams that are, you know, lost some membership and stuff like that. But, boy, at the state tournament, it was really well attended, a lot of good energy, and certainly a lot of people out there still interested in the sport every day.
Kaylee, why do you think participation is so strong in Wisconsin?
I think there's a couple of reasons. You know, show skiing in general is very much a family sport. Dan's entire family is involved with him, with his wife riding in the boat and his two kids skiing. My family is involved. My sister skis. My dad rides in the boat. My mom also rides in the boat. So it's very much a family sport, and I think that that's what people love about show skiing in general. Specifically in Wisconsin, you know, we have a short window for summer. You know, that 3-month mark, you know, while it is very, very, very fun, you know, at the end of that 3 mark, that 3-month mark, it can be quite exhausting. So, you know, I think for us, just that short window allows us to put as much effort as we can into those 3 months rather than spreading it out throughout the entire year. So I do think just Wisconsin is a great place for show skiing. And obviously the number of teams shows that.
And you've competed internationally. What is it like to compete on the international stage?
Yeah, so a couple of the members of our team have been selected on the U.S. team to compete with Team USA for show skiing. It's very fun. You know, we've been lucky enough to travel to other countries. We were actually in Australia last year. We've also traveled to Canada, and then we've had some of the world championships on U.S. soil. It's so fun. It's fun to see, you know, what people from other countries are doing in the world of show skiing. It's very much a friend and family thing, so it's great to just see all of our friends from all over the world. But definitely it does up the competition. You know, there's 35 of the best show skiers in the entire country competing. So talk about pushing the envelope and, you know, trying our hardest to see if we can put on the best show.
So, Dan, explain why show skiing is not in the Olympics.
Well, there's a few reasons. You know, the scoring method is kind of clunky, let's say. And Olympic sports are generally required that scores are presented instantaneously after the show is done. The other reason is that the boat that is involved. All other Olympic sports rely on gravity and, you know, just water. There's no other Olympic sport that requires, or that could be Olympic sport, that would require an engine. And so that's kind of been the limiting factor for many years as the conversation has evolved. But as Kaylee mentioned, you know, the U.S. does have its own national team. It's just not in the actual Olympics, but it's still treated like an Olympic sport. And we do, you know, with those competitions that happen across the world, we get to see the competitors from other countries. So although it's not in the Olympics, it's like the Olympics.
Kaylee, how can people get involved in competitive water skiing?
Well, specifically for the Aquanets, in order to join our team, you have to be a strong slalom skier, which means you have to be able to ski on one ski. We hold tryouts a few times a summer. I know that's, you know, the same for several teams throughout Wisconsin. I would encourage anyone who loves the sport of water skiing to try and get involved in their local ski team. It's a great way to just make friends and be out on the water and do what we all love. So, yeah, it's great.
Well, Kaylee and Dan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much
for having
us.
Dan Borman and Kaylee Kohler, they are co-directors of the Twin Lakes Aquanuts, the 2021 State Water Ski Champions. Ahead this hour, we check in with an emergency room specialist on how the ER has changed in the pandemic. What has your hospital or clinic learned in these times? What protocols will stay in place for good? It's 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a look at the model minority myth.
Over the last year, the global pandemic has helped amplify historic racial tensions within the U.S. This includes ongoing racial struggles the Asian American community has experienced for quite some time. Mycy Vang of Sun Prairie has been thinking back on these experiences in her own life.
The model minority myth depicts Asian Americans as characteristically successful and less troublesome than other minority groups. Before the COVID pandemic, this stereotype has allowed the racial targeting of Asian Americans in the past to be essentially overlooked. Hmong Americans have a unique story. Not only have our anti-Asian encounters been unnoticed, but being lumped in a race that is inherently successful has caused other issues to be ignored as well. My earliest recollection of not having similar advantages or privileges than that of my fellow Asian Americans goes back to the third grade. My siblings and I were living what we believed were typical childhoods in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, walking home from school, being latchkey kids, and trying to keep out of trouble while my parents worked rotating in overnight shifts at packaging and paper mill jobs. But while I played on train tracks and explored abandoned train stations and warehouse buildings, my Japanese-American classmate received private cello lessons and studied classical music. I also had an Indian-American classmate who received solid academic and career guidance very early on in life. She knew exactly what she wanted to be when she grew up for as long as she could remember, a medical doctor. While most children at some point in time want to become a doctor, this friend knew what specific steps she needed to take, what subjects she needed to study, and to what colleges she wanted to apply. I moved away shortly after, but our paths crossed again when I was a senior at UW-Madison. I learned my old friend indeed was still on that career path, with plans to attend medical school in the fall. It's extremely rare for a child that young to carry through with such detailed plans, but the fact was that she actually had plans, a strategy, and was aware of opportunities before her. I didn't know there was postgraduate education until much later in life, and even then, schooling beyond a four-year degree was unimaginable. I can't help but think how different it was for the Hmong to be included in a race in which we didn't have the comparable advantages, skills, and education. The Hmong is an ethnic group from Southeast Asia with no country or nationality. We didn't have a written language until the second half of the 20th century. We were persecuted throughout history and repeatedly forced to migrate. It was only our participation in the CIA's secret war during the Vietnam conflict that we were granted refuge in the U.S. I seemingly speak of first world problems, complaining about not receiving private music lessons or professional career guidance, but when I really look back, we oftentimes were not provided some essential social services presented to other minority groups. Hmong children and parents were rarely considered for English language support classes. We didn't have sufficient guidance to help assimilate into our communities, to ensure basic needs were met, or that racism was addressed. I participated in numerous African American awareness and appreciation events, and I brought home bilingual Spanish pamphlets, but my Hmong parents were never able to fully comprehend the communications given to them or know what was really happening in their children's social or academic lives. Despite these circumstances, Hmong Americans have come far in our few decades in America. We have fulfilled American dreams, but just like the Mata minority stereotype not applying to all Asian Americans, not every Hmong experience is the same. In addressing the uniqueness of each minority group or individual can help dispel myths so that we can better understand each other and help each other reach our full potentials.
Maisy Vang is a writer who lives in Sun Prairie. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to the spread of COVID and how emergency departments have taken stock in these pandemic times. The CDC has updated guidance and is now urging even fully vaccinated people to mask up indoors in areas of high COVID spread and universal masking in schools. Do you work in healthcare? What has your facility learned from COVID? Do you feel prepared if the Delta variant cases surge in your community? It's 800-642-1234. Dr. Richard Shimp is an emergency medicine specialist at Ascension Columbia St. Mary's Hospital, Milwaukee. Dr. Shimp, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. There is nowhere near enough vaccinated people yet to stop the spread of the Delta variant. What are you seeing? What are conditions like at your hospital?
Conditions at the hospital are much like what we're seeing across the state of Wisconsin with rising COVID illness along with rising hospitalizations.
Yeah, rising hospitalizations, and certainly we've been seeing hospitals filling up in southern states. If cases rise, do you feel your ER is prepared to handle a high volume of patients like we saw earlier in the pandemic?
We do. You know, early on the pandemic, we really had to learn on the fly in emergency medicine as well as healthcare and adopt with limited knowledge of what was to lie ahead, along with some limited experience in the treatment of this novel virus, as well as we didn't know the future of how long this may last. So if there is a silver lining that could be said from a pandemic, it's we've learned a lot and we can apply those learnings, not necessarily limited to another surge in this, but really any healthcare situation. And so we've learned to be adaptable. We've learned to add new technology and, quite frankly, learned to add new clinical care to the treatment regimen of really all patients.
How have you learned to adapt, starting with that first one?
Well, you know, early on it was, our saying was that things are going to change with every sunrise and sunset, and that couldn't have held truer. But really, we became adaptable in really a surge in patients. And so we began using non-conventional treatment areas. And you may have recalled seeing military-type tents outside of facilities. That was really to manage large surges of patients. But even internally in the hospital, we learned to use conference space, large conference space to triage patients and maintain social distancing. So we added virtual technology. So handheld devices, as simple as a cell phone, a tablet, a laptop, anything with a camera where we could interact with our patients in a safe, socially distanced manner, yet keep high quality of care and safety. That was implemented, as well as further into the hospital, managing critical patients. When ICU capacity was full, we learned that we could use our operating room recovery space to serve as intensive care units. So there was quite a bit of adaptability and innovation built in that, quite frankly, today we stand ready to do the same for any surge in demand of services.
I'm wondering, as you look around, how that impacts staff and whether you have seen the impact of burnout, of staffing shortages, of turnover, retirements.
You know, certainly the pandemic has really put unprecedented stressors on everybody, whether it's your personal life or professional life. And what was most important to us was to recognize that and really provide as many support services as we can. And that was as formal as employee assistant program resources, daily prayers, daily reflections. We built quiet spaces in our hospital that continue to exist today for associates just to get off stage for a moment or meet in private with their peers to share experiences. There was also entertainment. We continue today to host virtual 5K runs. There are food truck days, employee appreciation days, employee spirit days, everything to really bring a sense of normalcy back to the very, very serious work that people have been doing for the last 16 to 18 months and likely in the future ahead.
Yeah. I'm wondering, can you easily cover those ER shifts? Have you been able to make sure your whole healthcare team can be there without people working so many extra hours?
We can. Fortunately, we have been able to continue to serve, you know, both the COVID patient population as well as the day-to-day emergency department emergencies, if you will, with our current staffing. We have an incredibly dedicated team of associates in a profession where I think they're not afraid to step up despite some of the pressures upon them. And it truly has been a team sport. And it starts with the minute you walk in the door to the first person you meet through nutritional services, environmental services, lab, pharmacy, respiratory therapy, nursing, physicians. Everybody that touches the patient is such an important team member. And out of this, we have learned to really utilize those resources in ways that now have proven to be quite successful. So that frankly, we can continue to provide emergency care.
It seems, Dr. Shimp, you've made some really novel changes in the way you triage patients and how you use your workspace in the hospitals. But what are waiting times like in your ER? Has that been affected by the volume of patients?
You know, it really hasn't. We've been fortunate to have rapid triage and a, quote, pull to full model where we essentially historically have eliminated triage and brought patients directly back to the treatment area where triage would take place. So we really haven't seen an appreciable change in triage. We do remain prepared, however, that if surges were to return, we could turn on the virtual technology today and begin that virtual triage to continually meet these expectations of providing care in a safe, high quality and efficient manner, despite the conditions and environment around us.
We have Dr. Richard Shimp specializing in emergency medicine in Milwaukee as we look at how ERs have changed in the pandemic. Do you work in an ER? What was it like during the surge in COVID cases? How would you compare operations then and now? Has your ER made any changes that are here to stay? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Shimp here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The COVID surge across the country is putting pressures on hospitals once again at a time when some are busy catching up with surgeries and elective procedures that were put on hold earlier in the pandemic. What is the situation like at your hospital? How is staffing? What about recruitment of new nurses and other roles on the healthcare team? Can you fill open jobs? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Dr. Richard Shimp is an emergency medicine specialist at Ascension Columbia St. Mary's Hospital, Milwaukee. He's with us for about 9 more minutes. Dr. Shimp, is Ascension Wisconsin requiring its employees to get vaccinated for COVID?
You know, for the safety of the community that we serve, as well as for our associates, Ascension will require COVID-19 vaccination for all associates by November 12th.
How is uptake currently, would you say?
So uptake currently is aligning with what we're seeing across both Wisconsin and national. And roughly speaking, two-thirds of healthcare professionals in the area with vaccination.
And when you talk about the COVID vaccine with people who come through your ER, are there ways for people to get vaccinated on site right there while they're in the ER?
There is, and we're really proud and excited to have really addressed the disparities in healthcare, both racial, ethnic, demographic disparities that exist in healthcare, and it really became apparent during the vaccination in this pandemic. And when we were able to implement vaccination within the emergency department as well as the hospital, it's really made a difference. You know, these are not the emergency room, as many know, is not a place for preventative care. But boy, during a pandemic, we learned quite quickly that this is a great opportunity to provide preventative services such as vaccination. And so, yes, we are currently vaccinating in our emergency departments as well as within our hospitals for patients that are coming in with conditions completely unrelated to the pandemic.
What reception are you getting when you are offering these COVID vaccines in the hospital?
You know, it's a personal decision, but it's given us opportunity to answer questions with the patient in a private manner, in a one-on-one manner. And I can tell you the uptake has been very good. There's been on the order of hundreds that have been vaccinated through this program just in the last couple months. So we continue to be proud of this, continue to be excited, continue to really work in our mission of providing healthcare, high quality care to those most vulnerable in our community.
How do you see the pandemic affecting mask wearing long term among medical professionals in the ER and in the hospital?
You know, that's a great question. And, you know, looking back in conversations with my colleagues over this pandemic, the one thing that we all seem to agree is that, at least for us one-on-one with patients, likely masking will continue into the future as far as we can see. You know, interestingly, prior to the pandemic, we see some infectious diseases, but never to the order and magnitude and severity of the COVID virus. And there were times that each of us recall we would wear an N95 maybe a handful time of the year in our careers, now wearing them nearly daily in high-risk situations. So I would anticipate we'll see masking for good reasons in healthcare for quite some time.
And then certainly those masks to your patients, they don't seem so odd anymore, I would assume. Or you wouldn't be like, why isn't that person in the surgery suite, for instance?
Yeah, that's right. And while masking is safe, we have to get used to recognizing our colleagues and our friends, you know, by their eyes and not their full face. So it has depersonalized the patient interaction, and we're sensitive to that and trying to take measures to really personalize care, as we always support at Columbia St. Mary's in Ascension. But there are challenges that have come from masking, and a lot of it has been personal contact and relationships.
We're talking with Dr. Richard Schimpf of Ascension Wisconsin, an emergency medicine specialist in Milwaukee, as we learn takeaways at this point in the pandemic in the healthcare setting. Are you a medical professional? What does your facility learn from COVID? Do you feel prepared if the Delta variant cases surge? 800-642-1234. Telemedicine, also a big milestone in this pandemic. What adaptations have you seen with that area in reaching patients via telehealth?
We like I said, you know, we've seen it both in the emergency department for triage, But we've also added the technology for an observation unit. So patients that may need 24 to 48 hours of care in the hospital we do now have the ability to have physicians round on them virtually, which has proven to be very satisfying to patient care. That allows the physician to see more patients over a period of time, maintain social distancing during a pandemic, but also continue to meet the needs of patient care. So I do anticipate that telehealth service will continue, but also opportunities for consultants to be involved with patients. You know, oftentimes consultants are in super specialists such as infectious disease or toxicologists. Subspecialty care is not readily available in every community across vast reaches. And by leveraging virtual and telehealth technology, we bring that level of specialty care to more patients and give more patients access to specialty services. So that's been a very exciting adaptation from the pandemic that, again, will continue, along with post-discharge, hospital-at-home virtual services and monitoring patients at home. During the pandemic, we have the ability to send patients home with oxygen monitors that we can follow each day and pick up changes that would prompt a visit to either the hospital or their primary care physician. So really,
those oxygen monitors would be connected. Those would be like smart monitors where you could see those signs, through if they're like hooked up digitally.
Yeah, that's correct. Depending on the technology platform, some can be automated. Some are simply manual, similar to a glucose monitor at home where the patient would write down the values and then check in with their primary care provider.
What are you grappling with, Dr. Shimp? What is the hardest challenge for you right now at this point in the pandemic?
You know, the hardest challenge is really seeing the end of a pandemic. This has been incredibly impactful to our community. It's incredibly impactful to healthcare. And the one thing that we can all do to end this pandemic and get on with our lives that I think we all want to get on with is to have large-scale vaccination. We know that the vaccine in healthcare with experts, that the vaccine is safe, the vaccine is effective at decreasing illness, the vaccine is proven to decrease hospitalizations, the vaccine is proven to decrease death rates. And in an effort to keep everybody safe, decrease the number of lives lost, and decrease the impact that this is having upon our community, I deplore people to get the vaccine. It is so vitally important.
Dr. Shimp, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Dr. Richard Shimp is an emergency medicine specialist at Ascension Columbia St. Mary's Hospital, Milwaukee. Just ahead, we discuss breastfeeding. A nutritionist is here to help us understand the challenges that people are facing and how the pandemic is contributing to those issues. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.